Hello, Illinois Radio Reader listeners. This is Elizabeth McMahon with The Pantograph for Thursday, November 6th, 2025. I'm going to start today on the front page and work my way toward the back. I'll do sports and obituaries in the second half. The front page story today has the headline, Global Flavor, A Family Affair, with a large picture right above the fold, and the caption reads, Sushi Primo's co-owner and sushi chef Noe Castro Ortega prepares an order at the restaurant, and this is at Sushi Primo's in Normal, and the story is about that restaurant, and I will begin. For Elizabeth Castro and her husband Noe Castro Ortega, bringing global flavor to Bloomington Normal is truly a family affair. The couple opened Sushi Primo's in March 2024 at the former site of Meatheads at 701 South Main Street on Illinois State University's campus in Normal. It's mainly just us, our family, said Castro, a Twin Cities native who graduated from Central Catholic High School and Heartland Community College. The restaurant staff includes her brothers-in-law, who work as sous chefs, several nieces, and sometimes the couple's 14-year-old daughter, who primarily takes orders and cleans tables, but can help with any task in the restaurant. Occasionally, on really crazy days, my mom comes. The younger family members also came up with the business motto, seen on the back of employees' shirts, roll into blissful taste, roll out with Sushi Primo's. Sushi rolls are crafted by Castro Ortega, who's originally from Mexico but learned the art from a Japanese chef from California. Ingredients are shipped weekly on Tuesdays, and all prep work is handled by restaurant staff. I feel like ingredients are a huge thing, but also we roll everything as it's ordered, Castro said. We don't pre-roll anything. I mean, even the crab rangoons are made from scratch. Most popular is the Jason's Crab Rangoon Roll, made with crab, scallions, and a cream cheese mix topped with sriracha, eel sauce, and spicy mayo. It's rolled with rice and seaweed, then fried with tempura batter. Appetizers at Sushi Primo's include crab rangoon, edamame, fried chicken, fried shrimp, and spring rolls. The menu also features a variety of sushi rolls, both cooked and raw, along with combo plates, bowls, vegetarian options, and seasonal specials. Sides range from ginger and rice to sauces such as spicy mayo, eel sauce, wasabi mayo, sweet chili mayo, and sriracha. Customers can also order miso soup, drinks, and other add-ons to complete their meals. The restaurant hosts a monthly competition where customers can design their own sushi rolls, with the winning creations added to the menu under the customer's chosen name. Castro Ortega prepares sample rolls based on customer submissions, and the staff votes on their favorites, usually selecting three or four new rolls each month. Winners also receive a gift card and a t-shirt. This month's menu feature is a gonzo roll, which Castro described as similar to a Philadelphia roll, but topped like a rainbow roll with a different kind of fish. Her personal favorite is the Angry Bird roll, made with chicken tempura, avocado, and cream cheese, topped with spicy crab, eel sauce, and tempura crunch. She also enjoys ordering the half-and-half order of spring rolls and crab rangoon to share with her two-year-old. Castro also works in student health services at ISU, giving her an appreciation for the needs of the restaurant's nearby customer base. I feel like that's important to have a reasonably priced food for those kids, she said. The family works to cultivate a welcoming atmosphere for customers, hosting trivia nights that draw a strong turnout every other Wednesday. Castro enjoys networking with customers, meeting new people, and hearing their stories. We try and be kind and friendly to everybody, so I feel like that's important too, she said. There are no plans for additional locations, Castro said, but possible future expansion would likely be targeted to other college campuses. Sushi Primo's is open from 11 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. Sunday through Thursday, and open until 10 p.m. Friday and Saturday. Indoor and outdoor seating is available, as well as self-service and online ordering. That story was by Olivia Jacobs. And next I'll move on to a Supreme Court-focused story with the headline, Supreme Court Weighs Trump Tariffs in a Trillion-Dollar Test of Executive Power. This is an Associated Press story by Lindsay Whitehurst. President Donald Trump's power to unilaterally impose far-reaching tariffs was before the Supreme Court on Wednesday in a pivotal test of executive power with trillion-dollar implications for the global economy. The Republican administration is trying to defend the tariffs, central to Trump's economic agenda, after lower courts ruled the emergency law he invoked doesn't give him near limitless power to set and change duties on imports. The Constitution says Congress has the power to levy tariffs, but the Trump administration argues that in emergency situations, the president can regulate import taxes like tariffs. Trump called the case one of the most important in the country's history and claimed a ruling against him would be catastrophic for the economy. The challengers argue the 1977 Emergency Powers Law Trump used doesn't mention tariffs, and no president before has used it to impose them. A collection of small businesses say the uncertainty is driving them to the brink of bankruptcy. The case centers on two sets of tariffs. The first came in February on imports from Canada, China, and Mexico after Trump declared a national emergency over drug trafficking. The second involves the sweeping reciprocal tariffs on most countries that Trump announced in April. Multiple lawsuits have been filed over the tariffs, and the court was scheduled to hear suits filed by Democratic-leaning states and small businesses focused on everything from plumbing supplies to women's cycling apparel. Lower courts struck down the bulk of his tariffs as an illegal use of emergency power, but the nation's highest court might see it differently. Trump helped shape the conservative majority court, naming three of the justices in his first term. The justices so far have been reluctant to check his extraordinary use of executive power, handing him a series of wins on its emergency docket. Still, those were short-term orders. Little of Trump's wide-ranging conservative agenda has been fully argued before the nation's highest court. That means the outcome could set the tone for wider legal pushback against his policies. The justices have been skeptical of executive power claims before, such as when then-President Joe Biden tried to forgive $400 billion in student loans under a different law dealing with national emergencies. The Supreme Court found the law didn't clearly give the president the power to enact a program with such a big economic impact, a legal principle known as the Major Questions Doctrine. Challengers say Trump's tariffs should get the same treatment since they'll have a much greater economic effect, raising some $3 trillion over the next decade. The government, on the other hand, claims the tariffs are different because they're a major part of his approach to foreign affairs, an area where the courts should not second-guess the president. The challengers also are trying to channel the conservative justices' skepticism about whether the Constitution allows other parts of the government to use powers reserved for Congress, a concept known as the non-delegation doctrine. Trump's interpretation of the law could mean anyone who can regulate can also impose taxes, they say. The Justice Department counters that legal principle is for governmental agencies, not for the president. If he eventually loses at the high court, Trump could impose tariffs under other laws, but those have more limitations on the speed and severity with which he could act. The aftermath of a ruling against him also could be complicated if the government must issue refunds for the tariffs that collected $195 billion in revenue as of September. The Trump administration won over four appeals court judges who found the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA, gives the president authority to regulate importation during emergencies without explicit limitations. In recent decades, Congress ceded some tariff authority to the president, and Trump has made the most of the power vacuum. And finally, on the front page, we have a Capital News Illinois story by Ben Zielinski with the headline, Illinois Bill Decouples State Federal Taxes, Raising Revenue and Angering Businesses. There's a picture here of Governor J.B. Pritzker taking questions in his Capitol office as well. Illinois lawmakers are sending a bill to Governor J.B. Pritzker that makes a pair of changes to Illinois' tax code in response to new federal tax provisions that could reduce state revenue. The governor's Office of Management and Budget projected last month that Illinois is on track to run a $267 million deficit in fiscal year 2026. That's partially a result of corporate tax cuts enacted at the federal level as part of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, officially known as House Resolution 1, that President Donald Trump signed on July 4th. Many states, like Illinois, tie sizable portions of the tax code to the federal government's policies. That means H.R. 1 would also reduce the amount of revenue the state receives unless Illinois takes the action. Pritzker's budget office recommended in its last report, last month, that state lawmakers pass a bill to decouple parts of the state's corporate tax code from the federal tax code to address this year's deficit and allow the state to receive taxes it otherwise would not have received because of H.R. 1. The House voted 76-33 and the Senate 37-19 to pass Senate Bill 1911. If signed by the governor, it would erase about $250 million from the projected fiscal year 2026 deficit. The purpose, ultimately, is to make sure that we can pay bills in the state of Illinois and not be hampered by Donald Trump and the big government bill, Pritzker told reporters in Springfield last week. One change approved by Congress allows manufacturers to claim a larger deduction for assets as soon as they go into service, allowing businesses to save more money in the short term. By stopping that change from applying to Illinois, the state would save $144 million in FY26, according to an analysis by Senate Democrats shared with Capital News Illinois. One change would actually align Illinois' tax code with the federal government by redefining a tax on businesses' overseas profits that state lawmakers passed in May as part of the FY26 budget. That ensures the state can collect an expected $90 million in revenue from the tax this year. The state is also extending a measure that was put in place in 2021 pertaining to filing taxes as pass-through entities. Senate Democrats say it would save businesses money on federal taxes without impacting state coffers. It was slated to expire this year, but will be made permanent under the measure. That's revenue that doesn't have to go to D.C., that can stay here in Illinois, Taxpayers Federation of Illinois President Maurice Scholten told Capital News Illinois. Illinois business owners can spend it in the communities or further invest in their businesses and expand and hire additional workers. Some business organizations worry the measure will hurt Illinois' ability to attract and retain businesses. Illinois Manufacturers Association CEO Mark Densler said changes to the depreciation of assets deduction will hamper economic development efforts and put the state at a competitive disadvantage. This measure deprives Illinois manufacturers of important tax benefits that allow businesses to upgrade equipment, expand facilities, and grow jobs, Densler said in a statement. It represents yet another blow to our state's manufacturing industry. Pritzker defended the policy, arguing that businesses will still find Illinois to be an attractive place because of the state's infrastructure, education, and healthcare systems. Republicans said the federal government's tax cuts would also be beneficial to Illinois. When the federal government tries to, you know, add rocket fuel to manufacturing and other industries, we shouldn't have to be the outlier, Representative Amy Ehlich, a Republican from Godfrey, said during debate in the House last week. We should be taking advantage of these opportunities and helping businesses decide to locate here. Scholten argued the taxes Illinois is decoupling from will negatively impact the state in the future. This change pushes Illinois' corporate tax structure even further out of line when you compare it to other states, Scholten said, and we understand that lawmakers were trying to balance a difficult budget, but relying on higher business taxes every time revenue falls short can create a vicious cycle that ultimately weakens Illinois' tax base in the long run. Despite warnings from the governor's budget office about FY26 ending in a deficit, the latest data from the General Assembly's Independent Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability shows FY26 revenue remains up through October compared with FY25. The October report released Tuesday shows total general fund revenue for the year remains 2.9%, or $474 million, above this point last year. Much of that growth stems from a transfer from the state's income tax refund account, but other sources, such as sports betting and sales tax, have also grown despite concerns about the economy slowing. Corporate income taxes continue to be down for the year. However, it's down 14.1% or $228 million for FY26 so far. However, the state brought in 22% more corporate income taxes this October than in October 2024, following a substantial decline in September. Moving on in local news, we have a story here by Drew Zimmerman with the headline, Reditus Laboratories ordered to pay $5.5 million settlement in whistleblower case. A $5.5 million settlement has been reached in a 2022 civil suit alleging Aaron Rossi and his now-shuttered medical startup Reditus Laboratories committed fraudulent bill practices and made false claims for payment. Dr. Laureen Legata, who served as a medical director at a Reditus-affiliated lab, filed the lawsuit under seal in June 2022. Her complaint claimed Reditus Laboratories submitted thousands of false claims to Medicare, the state of Illinois, and private insurers for pathology services that were never performed. The defendants were also alleged to have billed the government for COVID testing services that were already covered by patients' private insurers. While an employee at Reditus Laboratory, Legata investigated, documented, and opposed the defendant's fraudulent billing practices, which was met with threats to silence her findings, according to her complaint. Legata was fired from Reditus in June 2022, which was believed to be in retaliation to her opposition. Considering these allegations, which were outlined in an indictment and civil lawsuit against Rossi, the state of Illinois declined to renew contracts with Reditus in March 2022. At that point, the state had paid the company about $222 million for COVID testing. Legata's attorney, David Fish of Workplace Law Partners, said he's happy Legata has been vindicated after a three-year ordeal. Legata came to us because she wanted to protect coworkers from getting into trouble, Fish said. Money was never really a concern for her, but unfortunately for her, after her employment was terminated, it put her in a position where she felt it was appropriate to cooperate. William Ziegermuller of the law firm Arendt Fox Schiff, who represented the defendants, did not return a request for comment on Tuesday. Under the terms of the settlement agreement, which was signed in October, Reditus Laboratories was ordered to pay $3.5 million, $2.17 million to the federal government, $1.05 million to Legata, $192,500 to the Illinois Attorney General, and $87,500 to Peoria County. Another $1.5 million would be transferred to a client trust account for Legata, and $500,000 would be paid to Legata's counsel. Taxpayers should never have to foot the bill for improper billing, Legata said in a news release issued last week announcing the settlement. This outcome isn't just about one lab or one person. It's about protecting our health care system and our communities. My hope is that this settlement leads to better safeguards and a reminder that no one is above the law, even during a crisis. Rossi, formerly of Bloomington, was charged in March 2022 by a federal grand jury with three counts of making and filing a false tax return after reportedly misrepresenting his income between 2015 and 2017. He was later charged with six counts of mail fraud after being accused of taking money from his previous employer, Central Illinois Orthopedic Surgery in Bloomington. Rossi accepted a plea agreement in February 2024, pleading guilty to one count of mail fraud and one count of making and subscribing a false tax return. He was sentenced to 60 months in prison for the mail fraud and another 36 months for the false tax return charge to be served concurrently. Moving on in state news, state-focused news, we have a Chicago Tribune story by Jeremy Gorner with the headline, Legislature Sets Stage for Illinois to Become a Right-to-Die State as Bill Narrowly Passes. Illinois stands to become the next state that would permit doctors to help terminally ill people end their lives after the controversial measure cleared its final legislative hurdle in a narrow state Senate vote in which opponents questioned the bill's morality and one said it could bring a culture of death to the state. The bill will go to Governor J.B. Pritzker, who will have to decide whether to sign it into law. If he does, the legislation would allow mentally competent, terminally ill adults the right to access life-ending prescription medication. The governor's office did not return a request for comment about whether Pritzker backs the legislation. If signed by Pritzker, Illinois would join at least 10 other states, among them Oregon, California, Colorado, and Hawaii, as well as Washington, D.C., in allowing medical aid in dying. The legislation received support from the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois and Compassion and Choices Action Network. This is a choice. If you are opposed to it, whether the reason is moral, religious, you don't like the idea, fine. I would never tell you you should choose this option, State Senator Linda Holmes, a Democrat from Aurora, and the main Senate sponsor of the legislation, said during floor debate. What I'm saying is why? Why? If I'm facing an illness where I'm going to die in pain, do you think you should tell me I don't have the option to alleviate that pain? The legislation was passed by a 30-27 margin in the Senate on Friday, 5 months after the bill barely passed the House 63-42, just 3 votes more than the minimum required for bills to pass by a simple majority. Opponents, including disability rights activists and the Catholic Church, said allowing terminally ill people to get help ending their lives could lead to discrimination, coercion, and abuse. Some medical practitioners also opposed the measure. In a statement, the Catholic Conference of Illinois asked Pritzker to veto the bill. With all the assaults on human dignity and the growing number of vulnerable people we see every day, sadly, the leaders and members of the General Assembly who voted for this offer a suicide as its response, the safe statement read. The bill now goes to the governor, and we ask him not only to veto this bill in totality, but also to address humanely the reasons why some view assisted suicide as their only option and to heed the impact of similar legislation on other states and nations. Debates over the bill in the House and Senate got emotional at times as lawmakers on both sides talked about their own experiences with death, either among family members or other people they knew. State Senator Chris Balkema, a Republican from Shanahan, detailed how both his parents died in hospice care. He said they became comfortable up to their deaths after being given a morphine pain reliever. While he thinks the medical aid in dying legislation is meant to curtail suffering, he cited reasons he didn't support the bill, including not feeling confident there were strong enough guardrails regarding the use of end-of-life medication. It's not right to introduce a culture of death into Illinois, said Balkema. We've never had this before. We've never had a situation where we're giving people an option to choose their life. We all, and 59 of us in this room, are compassionate. We care, and we want to preserve life the best as possible. This is going in the wrong direction. Republican State Senator Jill Tracy of Quincy also decried the legislation while the issue is debated on the Senate floor, echoing Balkema's sentiments about whether the bill's safeguards in issuing the medication were sufficient, while also raising concerns made by disability advocates that the legislation could be harmful to intellectually and developmentally disabled people. Tracy said she feared those individuals could be coerced or driven to use assisted suicide as a way to alleviate this population. The legislation outlines a deliberate process for someone who is terminally ill to be able to receive life-ending medication. According to the bill, an eligible patient may orally request a prescription for medication from their attending physician, and it must be documented. The patient must also request the medication in writing to their physician after making the oral request. But the patient must also make a second oral request 5 days after the initial one. The written request for the medication must also be witnessed by 2 people who attest that, to the best of their knowledge, the patient is acting voluntarily and is mentally sound, according to the bill, which also lists various limitations as to who can act as witnesses. At the time the patient makes the second oral request, the attending physician shall offer the patient an opportunity to rescind the request, the legislation states. Oral and written requests for aid in dying may be made only by the patient and shall not be made by the patient's surrogate decision maker, health care proxy, health care agent, attorney in fact for health care, guardian, nor via advance health care directive. An attending physician must also provide sufficient information to a patient regarding all appropriate end-of-life care options, including comfort care, hospice care, palliative care, and pain control, as well as the foreseeable risks and benefits of each. During floor debate, State Senator Adrian Johnson, a Democrat from Buffalo Grove, spoke in support of the bill, reading and paraphrasing a letter for the mother of a man who chose to end his life through medical aid and dying after he was sick with cancer. Johnson said the letter details how the man ingested medication to end his life, and his family was with him when he died peacefully in California, where the method of dying is legal. His mom goes on to say that it was bittersweet, and in his last days, he died peacefully because of the option of medical aid and dying in California where he lived, said Johnson. Dignity in dying is about ensuring individuals have a peaceful and humane end-of-life experience that respects their autonomy, comfort, and sense of self, she said. Also in the local news here, we have a story by the Pantograph staff with the headlines, Sons of the American Revolution chapter dedicates Liberty Tree at Constitution Trail. On Saturday, October 25th, the General Joseph Bartholomew Sons of the American Revolution chapter dedicated a tree along the Constitution Trail in Normal in recognition of the United States' 250th anniversary. The effort was part of the wider National Society Sons of the American Revolution America 250 Liberty Tree Project, which set a goal of planting 250 or more Liberty Trees in all 50 states before July 4th, 2026. Our local GJB chapter decided to plant our Liberty Tree along what seems the most fitting local location, the Constitution Trail, and with the cooperation of the Town of Normal, Parks and Recreation Department planted the Princeton Elm in June near the Connie Link Amphitheater so that over the years, as it grows tall and spreads its branches, people enjoy its cool shade in the summer, the local chapter stated in a news release. We gathered recently to dedicate this Liberty Tree in remembrance of the original Liberty Tree and Revolutionary Patriots, our local communities, and future generations. The October 25th dedication ceremony coincided with the NSSAR Great Lakes District Meeting held that weekend in Bloomington Normal and included remarks from NSSAR President General Michael J. Elston, the news release said. GJB Chapter President Jay Cummings emceed the ceremony, which also featured a trumpet solo of the Star-Spangled Banner and taps by Gabe Myers, the Pledge of Allegiance, the SAR Pledge, a proclamation by Normal Town Councilmember Karen Smith on behalf of Mayor Chris Coos, a prayer and dedication led by GJB Chaplain Reverend Ray Owens, and a flag posting by the Illinois State University ROTC Redbird Battalion and SAR Revolutionary Uniformed Color Guard members. GJB SAR 250th Liberty Tree team leader Dale Simpson also gave a presentation on the history of the first Liberty Tree in Boston. The event ended with officials applying fresh mulch around the tree and placing a 50 U.S. flag nearby. For more information about the GJB SAR or to contact the local chapter, go to gjbsar.org. Before I end this portion of part one of the Pantograph, I'm going to do the today's flick fact on page A2, and that's the question is, can you name the McLean County town that's peculiarly healthful and free of objectionable features, while its proximity to Bloomington gives it the advantages of a city, while its separate government secures it the quiet of a village? And the answer is, yes, it's Normal. That's as it was described on the first page of the 1896 Illinois State Normal University yearbook, then called the ISNU Index, 1896. Also mentioned in the yearbook from 129 years ago, Normal is connected to Bloomington by electric cars. Back then, a century plus before Rivian, it referred to the electric trolley cars. It referred to electric trolley cars. This is thanks to Brad Garricky. I'm going to take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Pantograph for Thursday, November 6th, shortly. Please stay tuned.